Welcome to the podcast of FEN's Virtual Forum 2020. We'll be looking at the highlights of day four, Tuesday, the 14th of July, and catching up with the people behind the events. First up, the Executive Director of FENS, Dr. Lars Christiansen, took time out to explain that even before the pandemic, the organisation was working out what it could do to protect the environment.
We were certainly not interested in greenwashing anything, and we wanted to have clean actions, clear actions on what we were proposing to do. So it should take real steps. And I think the best way of approaching that would be to actually discuss with experts. So part of that was that we realized we are not experts on CO2 emissions, for example. And we would very likely take wrong steps if we would not be able to work together with an independent agency that would look at our activity from an external point of view and with expert eyes on identifying what are the real sinners, if you will, and where are the real areas where we should approach the forum in the most effective way. It's difficult to be a conference attendee, a forum attendee, or an attendee to any scientific conference, of course, and you depend a little bit on the organizer to facilitate doing the right steps, I think. You can do a lot of things yourself, obviously. One of the main points is the CO2 emission linked to your travel. But when you go to attend meetings, and it's obviously available to everybody to offset their CO2 when they travel. It's something we have all been able to do for years, and something I encourage very much everybody to do, and something that we at FENS, we do for all of our scientific meetings now. So this is one step. But once you're at the meeting, there are very few things that you can do, because obviously you depend a little bit on kind of the choices that have been made for you. What kind of cups are available? What kind of transport has gone into the offer that you have by the caterer, for example? What sort of material has been used to establish the exhibition area? And all of those are things that you can't really influence very much, other than voicing the need for that, of course. You can look at the hotel you're going to stay at, or the housing that you're choosing for yourself when you're attending a conference. Different hotels, they have different policies, so there's clearly a choice. So clearly, as an organization, FENS, we rely on the community. The scientific community is a partner in these steps. We can only do so much. We can do actually very little without the support of the delegates. So we count on the community, and fortunately, I think we have a community that make better choices in terms of their environmental impact. FENS obviously has been trying to take steps to reduce our impact, our environmental impact, for some time, and this is now reached the forum, and this is an area where we think we can do a lot of positive changes. And we were planning all of these changes as we came into the forum year 2020, and the pandemic, the coronavirus hit the world, and we were going virtual for the FENS forum. So this has obviously changed our plans, but it's also making this FENS forum the most environmentally friendly forum that I think we can say that we have ever had. And I very much hope that our delegates will appreciate that, but will still support us for our physical meeting planned for July 2022 in Paris, where we will continue our movement to implement a meeting that is sustainable and that implicates all of those steps that we have already thought about and we had already started implementing for 2020 in Glasgow.
Dr. Lars Christiansen there, Executive Director of FENS. Next up, Professor Sonia Garrell delivered the ERA Net Neuron lecture.
So really what we want to understand is how millions of neurons assemble during the formation of the embryo and make circuits that function. And people have focused a lot on neurons and how glia emerging contribute to the process. But actually, over the past years, we've come to realize that also cells of the immune system that invade the brain very early on contribute, participate to the wiring of circuit, and also can relay some signals from the body or outside of the body into the system where the circuits are forming, and that it can have also long-term consequences on making functional or dysfunctional circuits. So we're really trying to understand what these immune cells do in the developing brain, how they act, but also what are the long-term consequences and how these cells can be at an interface between the wiring of circuits, signals coming from the body, and also from outside overall the environment and the microbiome. So my talk, so microglia, I think they're really important, interesting cells. It's fascinating. They enter the brain from the earliest stages. They do many things and they stay there throughout life. So really they could be doing many things. The microbiome I think is interesting, but honestly, I think the way we looked at it, it's not really a direct, I mean, it's not a very strong experiment. What I think is super interesting is the fact that we see that the microbiome already has an impact prenatally. So it means that the mother's microbiome is affecting everything coming from the outside can actually reach the developing embryo and the immune brain cells, which I find fascinating, and that it has an effect which is sexually dimorphic. So it means that microglia in males will be more impacted than microglia in female embryos. And this really, really echoes the sexual dimorphism or sexual bias that we see in disease, showing that, you know, so for me, this is really the fascinating part. And although we are still scratching the surface, we don't understand the mechanism. And I think that this is going to be the next very important thing on all the level. It's really a description. But I think that it really brings the need to dig in environmental influences, immune system interplay, and how all this could be sexually dimorphic, which is something that, you know, working on brain wiring, you only think about genetics and, you know, spontaneous activity and these kinds of things. We need to look at, you know, males versus females in the embryo, even if it's embryo. We need to understand genetic versus environmental issues. And we need to think more about putting the brain in the body in terms of understanding how it functions and how it wires and how it's regulated. And this is going to be an important switch from the neurocentric view. We've been moving to the neurocentric view, to the glial view, and now, you know, we can put it back in a full body relationship with the environment kind of thing.
We wondered how Professor Garrel felt about the forum moving to a virtual format.
I have split feelings. I think that at the same time, it's great that we can have the meeting. And I think that everything related to virtual has really, you know, virtual series of seminars and has really enabled to keep the science alive in this moment where we were all basically cut out. And to maintain interaction, scientific interaction, I think is a fantastic goal and mission and opportunity. So I think that this was important. At the same time, you know, we're all a bit tired of this virtual thing. And I just hope that, you know, people will show up and we're going to have a great scientific moment. But also I think that if people can take the time to look at the talks, not necessarily during the 4 days, and then contact people by email and really take the full idea of this going virtual, then I think it's going maybe to bring some more in-depth scientific interaction and build. It's going to be something different and new that we have to experience and live together.
That was Professor Sonia Garrel, who gave the ERANet Neuron Lecture. Our next highlight is Professor Tara Spires-Jones, who gave the Host Society Special Lecture.
I started work on the synaptic connections in the brain, a really neuron synapse-centric person. But the field of Alzheimer's research has changed over the past few years, and there's been all these clues that your genes can influence your risk for Alzheimer's disease. And a lot of these genes that increase your risk aren't really to do with the neurons, which are the thinking cells, the ones that we know to generate, but they're to do with the support cells, the microglia and the astrocytes, in particular the microglia. So I'm learning a lot of new things, and we're taking our expertise on the synaptic connections and finding out how these risk genes might be influencing the synapse loss, which is really the thing we think is driving the cognitive decline, because it tracks really closely with cognitive decline. So I think it's very exciting. I've got some fantastic PhD students working on it, and it ties into the other presentation that I'm not really presenting, but I'm chairing a symposium called Gene Environment Interactions in Aging and Neurodegenerative Disease. And both of these are linked, because what we're looking at in my main talk is this glia interacting with synapse loss, and that's driven by this genes in glia are important for risk. Well, in the symposium, we've got four fantastic speakers, one PhD student who I work with in Edinburgh, Professor Melanie Meyer-Lumann from Germany, Professor Anthony Hannon from Australia, Professor Gerd Kimberman from Germany, and Anna Stevenson is our PhD student. And anyway, they're all talking about this link between the things that you can do with your life and your lifestyle to modify your risk, and also the genes that we're all born with and can't modify, right? And how we can maybe reduce risk for some of these diseases and age-related cognitive decline. So it's a really important topic in the field. That's one of the big gaps in our knowledge, is understanding how, on the one side, genes change the brain to make you susceptible to diseases, and on the other side, how what we can do with our lifestyle can protect the brain and make it more resilient to diseases. I don't have anything profound that has hit me in quarantine that I think is world changing, but what we were able to do as a lab, the most thing I'm most thankful for is that my family are safe and healthy, our lab are safe and healthy, and I feel so lucky that myself and the people I work with were able to keep doing productive things, right? So we weren't completely isolated and unable to do any work. So we have gotten multiple papers written and submitted and reviewed, and we were able to tidy up a lot of data. A couple of students have really gotten deep into our statistical analyses, which I think they might not have delved into quite as enthusiastically if they could still be running experiments. So I think there are real upsides and personal upsides of spending more time at home. I used to travel too much, right? I love it. I love to travel, but as an academic, sometimes it's just too much. And so being able to actually be at home, work with my dog and my cat, and have my kids like actually see them and hang out with them has been awesome. But I will say, on the downside of, there's obvious downsides, of course, of the disease and the pandemic. But I think for a professional downside, I had been planning to write a big European grant for a deadline in August. And there's absolutely no way that the integrating homeschooling two children and trying to keep a lab and help people in the lab keep doing something productive, shutting down a whole department, restarting a whole department, the huge amount of incredible amounts of health and safety that goes along with this, it's just meant there's not space to think. There's not space to write and have new ideas, because when there's no, I'm in the bedroom, when there's no boundaries between your home life and your professional life, and I can't go sit in my nice office with a cup of coffee and it'd be silence. I've not had silence. This is remarkable that there's not been a dog or a cat or a child so far in the past 5 minutes. So I will say, on the downside, that's been tough. And I think that's going to be disproportionately tough for people who have caring responsibilities for women in science, for early career researchers, especially with caring responsibilities. So I've been thinking about ways to help in a small way to moving forward, because I think it's going to have a big impact. And the funding, of course, is going to be impacted. So.
And that was Professor Tara Spires-Jones, who delivered the Host Society special lecture. The recipient of the Fenns Kavli PhD Thesis Prize 2020 is Dr. Lisa Tranmuller. We congratulated her and asked her how she feels being a newly minted PhD.
It's an amazing feeling that you finally have this a journey kind of finished, even though the journey never finishes, right? There's always more things to do, always more open questions, but it feels good to have, you know, something completed. And so it was a really, really, really nice feeling. Something that has always interested me is how, you know, you and I, our brain is actually very similar. Like, if you put it in a scan, we have the same brain areas, their morphology, like the macroscopic morphology is very similar. We have the same types of neurons. But, you know, how is this actually generated? Like, what are the genetic programs that can actually modulate how a neuronal circuit actually is formed and developing and then acquiring its unique identity. And there's obviously multiple different ways on how people or us neuroscientists approach this. Something that we in the Scheifele Lab are particularly interested in is molecular programs that are post-transcriptional, which is alternative splicing. So we all know that our gene has a very good coding power, but we also know that we are limited in the amount of genes that we have. And it's quite interesting to see that if you compare, for example, mice and humans, that we are phenotypically very, very different, but we contain nearly the same amount of genes. And that's why we think alternative splicing is one of many cellular means and how you can actually generate diversity. And during my PhD, I was actually investigating alternative splicing programs and how those are actually aerated across different neuronal populations, such as excitatory and inhibitory neurons. And in addition, we also went a step further in basically trying to understand how one specific splicing regulator can actually lead to generate plasticity, how to generate neuronal wiring. And in the end, something that was really interesting to us was that alternative splicing seems to be really, really necessary and required for giving neurons their synaptic and intrinsic properties. And moreover, that splicing regulators such as RNA binding proteins can actually be not only diversifying, but can also be very important for specificity, because we basically found that very small changes on the RNA level, so basically modulation of one single exon in one gene that is encoding a cell surface receptor, can actually have drastic implications for how plasticity is generated in the brain and even on the behavior of the animal. So very small changes in splicing can have a drastic impact on the behavior of an animal. And I think this is something that we should really, that was really astonishing to us, to see that, you know, we are always trying to find major changes and a lot of different things that are changed, but actually very small changes do matter.
Having gained her PhD, what next for Dr. Traunmuller?
My plan was actually to move to Boston in August. but due to the COVID pandemic, this has been postponed. And I'm going to do a postdoc in Michael Greenberg's lab at Harvard Medical School, where I'm going to shift and not only look at basal activity and basal changes in gene expression, but actually how activity actually modulates circuit function and how transcription plays a role in that.
Dr. Lisa Traunmuller, winner of the PhD Thesis Prize. Professor Rui Costa's plenary lecture was entitled Discovering, Reinforcing, and Refining Actions.
How is it that we learn new actions, each of us? How do we learn the repertoire of actions that builds our skills throughout life? And the idea is, I'm going to talk about learning from consequence. So doing, trying, and then how do you redo? How do you re-enter the same neural and behavioral patterns that you did in the first time? So I'll start by explaining a bit how the cortical basal ganglia circuits and with dopamine act, or how their activity is during the doing. So when you initiate the movement for the first time, and how reinforcement and plasticity leads you to redo and then refine with training. So our results point to confirm a lot of previous hypotheses, but also point to new directions. For example, when we learn or reinforce something, we very quickly, even in one trial, we have learning. But the amazing thing is, if I do an action and I want to do it again, I don't actually zoom in right away in the same neural patterns or the same action that I did the first time. I do something similar. And then with time, it becomes more and more specific. So this is kind of a new way of thinking about learning and reinforcement, where very quickly, even almost with one trial learning, you can re-enter something very similar in terms of neural activity and behavior to what you just did, but then you refine with time. So the problem that people talk of credit assignment, how do you know which action led to the outcome you want, becomes a bit simpler to solve. You don't need to remember right away the exact action. You just remember the family of actions or the type of set or the neural space where you were when you did that. And that's what you re-enter right away. So it's very interesting, you know, because animals and humans in our hands very quickly go towards actions that are similar to the ones they did, but avoid very dissimilar actions, even without further training. So it's like a fast cognitive process. Of course, then I'll talk a lot about details about how cortical activity, activity in the striatum, and dopamine input from the substantia nigra actually mechanistically do this. And a little bit of computational work of how this comes about, but this is the gist of it.
Professor Costa also reflected on some of the side effects of the pandemic.
Of course, I'd rather be in Glasgow with my colleagues and interacting in person, but then I realized what an endeavor it is to continue to organize an event of this magnitude virtually. But I thought it's important, especially given the multinational, multicultural identity of FENS. It's important at a time where we see so much racist and anti-immigration behavior that FENS stands for saying science is universal and we need to go through. And this is a time where science is important. We need science. One aspect that I'm thankful for that happened during the quarantine was an increase in cohesiveness at our institute and people working together like I've never seen before to try to find cures, tests, and then even in their normal science, much more collaboration, discussion, people really came together. And especially my group was amazing, and we supported each other scientifically, emotionally, mentally, and we became even more a scientific family. So I learned a lot of lessons for the future. If we could have this type of coming together towards projects more in science and less egos and more understanding of each other's emotional and mental situation, this would be wonderful.
That's it for this time. Join us again tomorrow for Wednesday's highlights of the FENS Virtual Forum 2020. This podcast was made with the support of the Dana Foundation. The interviews were conducted by Shruti Muralida, Harry Potter, and Anders Jespersen. The music was by Kevin MacLeod, and the podcast was produced and presented by Malcolm Love. This is a FENS production. Find us at www.fens.org.